Hello, everybody, and welcome to another comedian's interview for my blog and podcast, A Rich Comic Life. My name is Richard Gill, and my blog describes my experiences of watching over 800 comedians and counting over the last 46 years. My guest today is the wonderful comedian, Mr. Stephen Grant. Yay!
Hello, Richard.
Hello, mate. How are you?
I'm fine. I'm a little worried. 800 comedians in 46 years. That's not right.
Clearly, I'm passionate about the world of comedy.
Yeah, more than most comedians with that level of input. Well done.
How are you doing? Are you all right?
Yeah, I'm surprisingly good for an industry in self-imposed incarceration. Yeah.
Oh, tell me about it. It's been a weird old year. Thank you so much for agreeing to do the interview. We're going to talk for about 45 minutes to an hour about your career in comedy.
Right.
And I'd like to go.
So we're going to have to pad for about 43 then.
And I'd like to go way back and. Ask you first, how did you become a comedian, please?
Okay, well, I kind of, as a kid, I was always interested in acting and stuff, even though I never really did it. Like, I went to, like, you know, did Saturday stage school and stuff like that, and was
right.
In productions and did a few other bits and bobs. So I liked performing. I kind of got the impression from family and people around me that that was only ever going to be a hobby. Not because I wasn't very good at it, but it's like it wasn't a very sensible thing to do. Went into the world of work. Around the age of 23, I started thinking, oh, I'd like to just do something a bit performing-like. And I remember as a sort of a teenager, sort of about 17, going to a comedy club because I was really young-looking. And it was the only way I could get served drinks because I would be with a big group of people. I used to work at a burger bar and they used to take me in. I used to watch comedy and I used to go to the Crocodile Comedy Club in Brighton. I remember Booty Graffo and Jeff Green.
Oh,
even
superb.
Eddie Izzard. Even Eddie Izzard was huge then, and we're talking 30 years ago. And so that was a big event to go and see Eddie Izzard. And remember, I could get served. And it was the only place I could drink. And I just kind of got into the comedy. So it stuck in my head. And when I got to my early 20s, I thought, I remember on those evenings out, as much as I had a good time, no one seemed to be having as good a time as the comic on stage. They seemed to be having the best time of all. And I thought, I want to have a try at that. So it was a New Year's resolution in 1997.
Wow. So that's when you started.
And so I spent most of the sort of autumn and Christmas of the year before, sort of 1996, writing jokes. I hadn't really ever watched much stand-up, so I didn't know how it would work, but it'd just be like things that I get really animated or think was quite funny, and I'd write, and obviously some of it was funny, some of it was awful.
Yeah.
And then I went on stage as February 28th, 1997.
Wow.
February 21st, 1997. And that was my first ever gig. I did 5 minutes in a pub function room in Brighton and it went very well. And I was just hooked. I thought, this is amazing. And I went back the following week and that went really well. And I thought, oh, I'm going to be huge. And I went back the week after that and I died. Oh, it was awful.
Oh,
terrible.
Mate.
Doing the same sort of joke. And I kind of became obsessed. How is it that, you know, the same person with similar jokes, with the same room, doesn't get the same laughs? What is it? And so I just became really just obsessed, but healthily, I felt, well, probably not healthily, retrospect, at the time it felt healthily, with what this comedy thing was, why it was so, why something can make people laugh and not make somebody else laugh, and, you know, just really became a real, not just a fan, but just a sort of, if you like, a student of it, really.
What I love about watching you is your incredible enthusiasm to get an audience laughing. Whenever I've seen you, and I've seen you many times over the years, you've just got this zest for life when you go out there, and it's wonderful to watch.
Enthusiasm for an audience laughing. That could be translated to just straightforward neediness, I think. It's a mixture of things. First of all, I'm sort of a fairly purist comedy that people are laughing. You're hard pushed to convince yourself it's funny. But also because that verification that comes with laughter is kind of, it vindicates your sort of professional existence. So much as I would love to, and I do talk about the things that I want to talk about, they get binned really quickly if they're not funny. I mean, really quickly.
Right.
So I would say that enthusiasm is part of excitement that I've found the thing that I find funny that other people would find funny. And also it's because I've got a fairly quick brain and I speak fairly quickly. And I remember an Edinburgh Review about 2001 that said, this thing with Stephen Grant is his jokes are a bit like buses. It doesn't matter if you miss one, there's going to be another one just behind it. So it's almost that law of diminishing returns. Yeah. If I keep batting out jokes that, you know, if you hear three jokes over a minute instead of one joke over a minute, then only one of them needs to be funny for you to laugh every minute.
So talk
quickly,
have
a lot of ideas. Yeah.
there you are with your first few comedy gigs. Were these all like 5-minute routines in pubs? Did you go along with, did friends come along with you to support you?
I think I didn't really invite them in the beginning because I think I didn't want friends to see me do badly.
Right.
I think I might have invited them. I think actually the close friends that would be really invested, the reason why, I'm trying to remember, it was actually a really good question, Richard. The reason why they didn't come is because before I did that first gig, I was haranguing them with, I've written these jokes, tell me what you think. So they were my audience for effectively all of my testing stuff out. I remember being just literally clutching a couple of printed pages of script and walking into town with a friend of mine going, so I've got this joke and it goes like this. Do you know the thing? I never really stopped to wonder whether that was acceptable behaviour or not. So I think by the time I got up on stage for my first show, I think the vast majority of my close friends had heard everything I'd thought of.
Wow.
And obviously didn't want to upset me by saying it's rubbish, but, you know, they needed to do that.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think they were relieved when finally it was strangers who were hearing my jokes rather than my friends.
Of course.
But it was 7 years before my parents saw me live perform.
Wow.
Yeah, and they lived in Brighton.
Wow.
And I lived in Brighton and I was performing in Brighton.
Wow.
And it was
seven years.
Yeah. I did actually say to them, why did you never come? And they went, well, you never offered. And I said, well, you never asked. And that was it. Just a kind of a 7-year impasse.
Wow. It's interesting because I go along to a lot of new comedy nights, and a friend of mine who won a comedy competition then started doing his 5-minute routines, and it was bring a friend to a pub, and I was the friend, and I must have seen his act about 25 times sitting in the front row, and he always used to say, laugh in the right places, and because I've got the laugh, I did, and it encouraged the other audience. But by God, I got sick of the routine. But he said it helped, obviously, because you could time the laughs and everything. But
your timing is affected. Though there are styles of comedy where the laughter is not quite as timing dependent, I guess. Like, you'll talk to a lot of the technicians of comedy and they'll always try to finish on a punchline. What kind of punchlines tend to be at the end? But you'll hear the ranty comics. You talk about a story, and when there's the, and you laugh through the lines. And there's a lot of clever sort of pausing and semaphore going on with their delivery to give you the space to laugh, but while it doesn't sound like they've reached the jazz hands end of the sentence to get the laugh. It's actually they are doing something a bit more sort of complicated than that. But it doesn't rely on their laughter to improve the timing, because it's not like you're hearing gaps in a monologue. So with rants, you will sometimes laugh over the top of people talking. You'll notice that when, you know, those ranty comics get those laughs, at the point at which you're laughing, they're normally saying something they've said a bit earlier, so the momentum is kept, but you're not losing any material, any jokes. And that's come back for me a lot more during the pandemic. I'm doing a lot more shows where I'm having to just talk to a camera and I can't rely. And even if it's a Zoom gig, you know, and I can see the other people, they're on mute and I can't hear their laughter. So I've got to pause in my head for it. So I'd say that ranty style suits the internet medium a lot better.
That's really interesting. I've seen you many times as resident host at the Crater Comedy Club in Brighton. How did the Crater Comedy Club start?
Well, the clue is in the name, Richard. No, genuinely, I've been running a few little pub gigs in Brighton just to get extra stage time since about 1998, something like that. And they were all quite more miss than hit, I'll be honest with you. Either the wrong place, the wrong audience. Sometimes a free to get in. I always thought free to get in is great, get a big audience. Didn't realise how tough a free audience is because they don't care. They're just going to the pub, you're in the way. So so it was, yeah, it was tricky in the beginning. And then Comedia moved from its old location, which was right by the seafront, to further into a part of town called The Lanes. And they took over an old supermarket.
Right.
And in the days when supermarkets were destroyed to build theatres, can you imagine that way around this time now? And I went along and I said, look, I want to run a sort of a stand-up comedy night. And they were a bit, they're quite theatrical and arty. And they were, well, it sounds a bit, you know, sort of end of the pier. We're a bit more kind of creative than that. I said, no, I promise it's, you know, it's cerebral. It's clever. It's, you know, it's artistic. It's funny. And they said, well, we'll give you like a Sunday night every fortnight or something. And so they kind of went into the room that they were going to convert, the main room, main space. And I went down this flight of stairs, and this room did not even have a floor. It was just metal pillars holding up the ceiling. Everything had been gutted. It was just water pouring through the walls, electrics, all the rest of it. And the floor wasn't even flat. It was this massive, like, bomb crater, and it was a crater.
Wow.
So it was the Crater Comedy Club, because the first time I walked in the place, it didn't even have a floor.
Wow.
And the irony of this is that I only ever mention that when people ask me why it's called that.
Wow.
Because the room was shaped like a crater the first time I saw it. But
that's amazing.
Because it's been closed for so long during the pandemic, they've had all sorts of water problems and stuff. Venues need to be run. If they're not run, they start going wrong.
Yeah.
And they've had to rip up the floor. And they're back right now. The venue is probably closest to how it was when it was, before it was opened in sort of like, and we started running it in early 99, so.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, it is, in my mind, one of the best comedy clubs in Britain.
Oh, thank you. It's
really
hard
is.
Work. It's easy to run a comedy club badly, and it's hard to run a comedy club well. You know, to run it well, you've got to just concentrate on a load of things that people don't even realize are important.
Of course.
Everything to do with light, sound, how people feel on the way in, having security who are friendly so they're not in a bad mood, not making them stand in the rain so they're pissed off and damp. You know, it's just so many things.
Yeah.
You know, and don't, you know, try not to ambush them with terrible drink prices before the show starts so they're not in a bad mood. It's so many things. But like the Comedia gets virtually all of it right. I'm very proud of it.
Congratulations to you. Congratulations as well, because you've appeared in many a comedy competition, most notably the winner of the Best Comedian at the Juicy Awards in 2003 and the winner of the Best Compere at the Chortle Awards in both 2008 and 2011.
They retired me after that.
Describe these experiences. Are you a fan of competitions?
No. No, but I mean, the thing about it is there's not, when I started out in comedy, oh God, I'm going to sound so old, but this is the case. There wasn't really the opportunity to self-promote with social media that exists now. So to get known, you were relying on word of mouth. And word of mouth in stand-up comedy is difficult because even when you're playing a big room, it's 200 people. You know, in television and radio, it's tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands.
Yeah.
So, you know, short of playing the festivals and all the press that comes with that, you know, you need to be sort of talked about.
Yeah.
And the only way really to do that as a new comic back then was to enter the competition. So they were a necessary evil. And it's kind of, I regret the competitions a little bit. And I'll tell you why. It's because if you're ambitious, and I certainly was when I started, less so now, I can talk about that.
Yeah.
That ambition is always about wanting to get to the top. And that makes you competitive. But being competitive is all about beating the people around you. And when you start out in comedy, those people around you, they're not your competitors. They're your colleagues. Mm. They're your friends. They're your support network. They're the only people who understand when you've had a tough gig what that feels like. Your other friends don't. And so going to a gig and wanting them to do badly because it's a competition and you want to win is not conducive to a good working environment. And I think that's something I got wrong. You know, I was competing with people and I wanted to be the best.
Right.
And you have to fight that urge that to be the best by everybody else being worse than you. I did well in the competitions, but I think a lot of the people I was in the competitions with, they should have been like my best friends in comedy. And it took a long time for me to kind of just go, like, you know, to be in a settled, happy place with them.
Right.
A lot of my friends in comedy aren't the people that I started out with, and I think competitions were a part of that.
That's interesting. I've watched many a competition over the years, and indeed, when I had the idea for this blog, I went to a half-day writing course which was run by the Amused Moose, and the woman there said to me, "We forget why we've invited you onto this half-day course." And I said, "Well, I'm not a diarist, I'm not a critique, I'm not a reporter, and what I am is a member of the audience, and I'm out to have a good time. And I regard my blog as an enthuse for all the people, all the comedians that actually get out and have a go." And she looked at me and she said, "Oh, we like you," because the rest of them were all wanting to be reviewers. And she moved on. She never bothered me again. And so it was my experience of seeing what it's like to be in a different kind of competition, but it was a similar thing where you were like jostling to try and be the best, and I thought, it's not what it's about, this. I'm just out to have a good time, and you know, that's why the blog took off, really, and the blog that's why I write it, and it's a continuous thing, you know. It's fascinating. I've talked to many a comedian about the competitions, and they've all said, you know, they've all got differing views on it. But it's very interesting what you say.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing wrong with being called... I'll take that back. There's something fundamentally wrong with being called the best comedian.
Yeah.
Because at best, you are the best comedian on the night.
Yeah.
And at best, you're the best comedian on the night in the mind of the people who are responsible for nominating you as the best comedian.
Sure.
And what's more is that if you work in comedy, you know, your position on the bill makes a huge difference.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, realistically, if someone said, "All right, I want you to test these 10 dishes and tell me which one's the nicest," it's never going to be the 10th, because the 9th one, you're completely full and you don't want to eat a few other thing. But that 10th dish could be the best one.
You won't
know unless you're really good at knowing that I've got to taste it and ignore this. It'd have to be the 3rd or the 4th one. And comedy is exactly the same. So to be the best comedian based on how you did once on one bill, based on where you were in the running order, based on who else was around you and how they felt, you know, and if you were in a room that suddenly had a massive stage, if you're the kind of actor who's really physical and dances around, then you'll catch people's attention. If you're one of these rooms that's got a really small, intimate stage and everyone's really close, but you're quite sort of quiet spoken at, that could be the best gig of your life. So the whole idea of the best comedian, yeah, fair enough, there are good comics and there are bad comics, but you wouldn't have a Premier League where you decided the end table after one game. And that's what comedy competitions are. They're a one game league.
Yeah. They're not
representative.
Yeah.
You know, and they're not representative. And also, you know, every comic here has had a tummy ache and gone to a gig and been okay, you know, or just happened to get a room with 20 people who just nailed the references they're talking about. And then suddenly they're the new hero and savior of stand-up. So it's, a good comic and a really good comic will be great all the time. But the bizarrest thing about comedy competitions are is they're almost exclusively aimed at new comedians.
Right.
And the hit rate with new comedians is so sporadic.
Yeah.
That it's just literally which way the wind is blowing. But yeah, a great comic should be funny all the time and a terrible comic can be terrible all the time. So typically the people who win comedy competitions are funny, you know, but at best what they were was the best on the day. And then just in the opinion of the people who are watching, you know,
sure,
that's why comedy judges are so important. That's why if you do a comedy competition and it's voted for by the audience, forget it. It'll be almost entirely down to who is in the right position on the running order.
Right.
But there was a time when comedy competitions were huge. When I went to Edinburgh, there were four competitions running. you know, three of which had a final in Edinburgh. The BBC New Comedy Award was in Edinburgh. The Daily Telegraph Open Mic Award, which was huge then, was in Edinburgh. And So You Think You're Funny, which is the only one that's still running of those three, was in Edinburgh. And all of them were televised, and all of them were had a final that was live in Edinburgh, and all of them were seen by hundreds of people. And it was really rare that someone would win both, two out of the three in the same year, but they would all be new acts. You know, yeah. I remember one year Peter Kay won two of the three. I think one year Phil Paul Foote won two of the three. That was it. You know, it was actually, do you know what? I think Peter Kay and Phil, Peter Kay and Paul Foote were both in the same year, so it couldn't have been the case. Sure. So I just, you know, it's just, yeah. I think competition's great if you can win them. Does show the fact that you're funny, but the best at the time, no. Ricky Gervais entered no comedy competitions. Ricky Gervais did not do Edinburgh. Yeah. Possibly one of the most successful comedians this country has ever created. So,
Oh, yeah, I totally agree.
It's a fallacy.
Let's move on to Edinburgh proper. My home city is Carlisle, but I've lived and worked in London for nearly 30 years. I go up to Carlisle every summer, and my holiday is the Edinburgh Fringe. I go there. I've been going there since 2005. I see about 50 shows in a week, and I absolutely love it.
50 shows in a week?
Yeah. I can't get enough of it.
I've done 60 in 4 weeks before while I was performing. So I went to see as many shows as I could around performing and rehearsing.
Wow.
And I saw 60. And I tell comics that's a lot, but 50 in a week, yeah, I'd have to be sponsored.
Yeah, I can't get enough of it. Tell me what your first Edinburgh Fringe was like, please. And what year was it? And how did you feel? And
so my first Edinburgh Fringe was... I've been up as a punter and got a chance to do a few little gigs while I was up there, but ignore that. But in 2001,
yeah,
I went and did a triple header, so that's kind of a three-act show,
sure,
as you should do when you first go up, so you can learn about the city, but not worry about whether you've got an hour show ready to go. And it was myself and Paul Foote and a woman called Veronica McKenzie. I've no idea what she's doing anymore now.
Right.
It's kind of a strong, confident, sassy sort of black act. And
yeah,
she was really, yeah, she was a really good sort of counterpoint on the bill. And I remember thinking she's really, really smart. Liked her. And obviously Paul is a unique comic proposition.
Yeah, he's great.
And the three of us did 20 minutes each. And it was a bit disjointed. And I'll tell you why, because your first Edinburgh should be a struggle. It should be difficult to get numbers. But my very first Edinburgh, we were full pretty much every night. And it wasn't just because Paul was excellent, which had in it, and he had all these sort of accolades from the previous year. It was because I was being followed by a documentary called Edinburgh or Bust, which was on Channel 4. And we're talking about very much pre-digital channels where people would watch, a million people would watch a channel because it was their only choice out of five, you know. And so I was on a Channel 4 documentary called Edinburgh Bust, and they were following me around as a new comic to see how my Edinburgh would go. But of course, it was completely non-representative because I was having a fantastic Edinburgh because I was being followed by a production company. I think documentary should be after the event, not in real time.
True, yeah.
So, you know, in the run up to Edinburgh, they were showing all the episodes of me doing the competitions and trying material out and what it was like to have a job and go to comedy. You know, they were showing what it was like for the new comic.
Sure.
So I was really well known in the comedy industry for being a new comic.
Yeah.
And so when I went up and did that show, I was full every night, but I wasn't ready for the level of attention I got. I'd only been doing comedy four years, of which maybe a year and a half of it was this is the whole point, isn't it? It wasn't 2001. 2001 was my first one-man show.
Yeah.
Scrub that. It was 99, something like that. It was 1999. I'll God, this is the problem. I'm going to actually have to look at this backdrop behind me to try and work out. It would be somewhere up there. 1999, I think it was, that I did that show. And it was, yeah, I was just too new, you know, to get it right.
Right. But during your Edinburgh runs that you've done, you've taken six solo shows up to the Edinburgh Fringe since 2003. I saw your show second in 2008, which I thought was outstanding. Describe your writing process, please, and where you get your ideas from for a show, if indeed you have a writing process.
It's the skeleton versus flesh approach. A lot of people start with the flesh. In other words, they write loads of routines, then look to see what joins them together, and then come up with a skeleton. So the idea is that that name of the show and the thing that joins it all together and the narrative arc and the path that the show will walk has been reverse engineered, because somebody has basically made the meat and the muscles and then has found something to hang it off.
Right.
I am a bit like that, but not really. I'm more skeleton first. What happens is I will write one or two routines and think, God, this opens the door to so many ideas. And second was a good example of that. Second was this whole concept of what does it mean in life to be successful but not a winner, to be second in things, you know. Yeah, and it was all talking about second class and second class post and, you know, second class travel and people who finished second in the Olympics, you know, the silver medalists and what means to them. And it was... because I had a couple of routines, maybe actually three or four that I'd written that had a kind of a concurrent theme. One of them being the runner up for being the new presenter in Top Gear.
Right.
Which is a lovely little story I've got. Well, I know it's lovely. It's up to everyone else whether it's lovely or not. About how I got down to the last two to be the new presenter in Top Gear.
Oh, congratulations.
Well, sort of congratulations, because what difference does it make? I'm first loser.
Something to go on your CV.
and I got phoned by Andy Wilman, the producer of Top Gear, to tell me that he thought I was brilliant, but I was just too similar to Richard Hammond. You see, Richard Hammond was there already. It was when James May came in. Right. But he said I was too similar to Richard Hammond, this sort of young, enthusiastic one. But if Richard was to ever leave the show, he would definitely give me a call, which was lovely.
Yeah.
Fast forward a few years, and then Richard Hammond crashes a car at 210 miles per hour and lands on his head. And I'm possibly the only person watching BBC News punching the air going, he's going to die. I mean, obviously, he's a lovely guy and he's got a family and et cetera.
Yeah, yeah. That
would be an awful thing to wish upon someone I don't know.
Of course
but
not.
Like, you know, I was so close. And, you know, so I've got this lovely little routine about me going, like, he's landed on his head. There's an air helic. There's an air ambulance.
You know, mate.
Like, come on, everyone. I'm going to move to a bigger house. You know, but like... and then I had a nice little one about you might have seen it as well, because I always try and do a lot of sort of, not multimedia, but try and build in ideas with stuff.
Yeah.
And I had a go at sending first class stamps and second class stamps to places to see which one arrived first, to see what is the difference between first and second. And we're also doing happiness of people on first and second class carriages, you know, but trying to see what the difference was. So, and quite often, nearly all the cases, the second class stamp envelope would arrive at the same time as the first class one.
Sure.
So I extended the idea out, and I would do one without a stamp, you know, to see if that arrives, with just the address. One with just, and then I'd just get rid of the address and just describe myself and see if that turned up like this, right? And then on the one where I wrote sorry, no stamp, what happened with that one is it sent it back to my return address, but because I was sending letters to myself to see when they arrived, it got back to me quicker than the first class stamp.
Oh, mate.
And sender. And I said to everybody, I said, if you want to send anything for free, put whatever address you like on the front, doesn't matter. Put the address on the back as your address, as the address you want it to go to, and on the front write sorry, no stamp. And people love this idea, the idea that you can send any post for free by pretending your sender's address is the address that you actually, the address you want it to go is your sender's address.
Sure.
And that idea plus the Top Gear idea brought it together. And also all of my Edinburgh shows have got a main theme and a kind of an underlying theme.
Right.
But the second one was about being second place and all that. But the underlying one was about second. It was the times, as in like building up, you know, the division of time, the second,
yeah,
which was in there as well. It's kind of, yeah. And like when I did Life's Too Short, that show was about, I think that was the year before in 2007.
Yeah.
And that was a lot about the fact that I've got an obsession with wanting to live forever. And, you know, and how could you do that? But it's also because it was probably one of the greatest criticisms I ever had growing up, which was to stop being so pedantic and anal and kind of over-analyzing because life's too short. And Taken for Granted being my name. So the loads of shows all had a kind of a main theme and an yes. under theme based on the title. So I kind of, and I enjoyed it. Edinburgh gave me the chance to be, you know, to not just take the ideas for jokes and turn them into routines, but allow me to come up with a theme and maybe have it explain stuff that people maybe hadn't thought of before, and reward people for listening to me for an hour.
Yeah, yeah. I think though, because of your way of, as I said before, being very enthusiastic with an audience, they're on your side when you walk on, because, or when you run around, because you're very enthusiastic, and therefore, if you wanted to get a point or a theme across to them, you're more freer to do that because you're commanding the entire room. Would you agree with that?
Well, getting the audience on side is one of these things you get taught in comedy classes, because
right.
they say that, you know, it's easier to laugh with someone you like, you know, because you can empathise, because you see where they're coming from, because you forgive them when they don't get it quite right.
Sure.
And also it's part of charm. I mean, look at John Bishop.
You know,
I'm sure if you wrote down his material and then read it back, you'd be thinking, oh, this is funny, but like, where's the wow in this? And of course, the wow in it is John.
Yeah.
Because he's this salesman and this charisma and this force of personality is so strong, you know,
yeah,
and it
yeah.
really elevates. And so, you know, you're taught early doors that if you can make that connection, it'll make your life a lot easier.
Sure.
But I started out in comedy with Simon Evans.
Oh,
and
wow.
Simon Evans would walk on stage, you know, when he was a new act and go, well, hello, ladies and gentlemen. My name's Simon Evans, and if you're having problems placing the accent, it is indeed educated. And he would talk down to the crowd right from the outset. He would play the highest status, you know,
yeah.
say not public school, you know, not normal school, just unlike you. I listened, you know, just, and he would just be not mean, but just higher status. And he would seek to distance
yeah,
the connection
yeah.
between himself and the audience, to elevate his status, to be, as he always told me, to be 8 foot tall.
Sure.
And so whereas it is a great technique and it is a an often sort of vaunted approach to comedy to make your life easier, to connect with the audience, doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Because if you're really funny, and Simon Evans is really funny,
mm-hmm.
doesn't matter, because they'll love you because you're funny. I mean, great. I love you, but there's other reasons, and the other reasons are as well, is that I need people on my wavelength because it's coming back, but also I will be dark from some time to time, and I need people to be okay with it, because they need to see that dark opinions coming from a positive, friendly person is funny.
Sure.
You know, so
yeah.
if I'm, you know, I've got stuff about the coronavirus at the moment, about just, you know, how much better the world will be if the old people die, you know, but I don't say it like that. It's a slow creeping thing where I add up the kind of logistical and the sort of the moral argument for the removal of the elderly. And it, obviously it's dark as hell, but it's done in a sing-song voice with a sense of kind of like, well, if it was the other way round, if coronavirus killed the young and left the old intact, I'm not sure they'd be following lockdown with the same level of vigor. I think they'd be dancing through the bingo's hall, shoulder to shoulder, without a care in the world, passing Werther's originals mouth to mouth, going, well, they played their music on the bus at full volume, using their phones, they had it coming to them. You know, so there's all kind of approach to it
that
allows me to get away with it. And if I didn't have that friendly connection, then there would be a distance.
Sure. You know?
And it's interesting because, of course, when you do that on social media, you don't have that friendly connection, so you get into trouble. Right. So when I try out my jokes on social media, and slightly darker ones, I get argued with, I get put down, sometimes by other comics as well, because it's bereft of the connection that allows you to do it.
Right. Sure. You know. Yeah.
So it's important to my comedy to be that.
Yeah. Yeah.
But not just as a kind of a comfort blanket for when the jokes are a bit mediocre.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Again, very interesting answer. What do you think makes a good compare?
The ability to be in the moment.
Right.
That's just number one. I mean, you know, there are the mechanics of comparing, you know, set up the show properly, make sure that everyone has a good time, keep control, you know, keep the energy up, or at least keep the energy where it needs to be for the act. There's loads of techniques and tweaks and everything that's there. And I'm really passionate about comparing as an art form.
Yeah.
And how important it is to comedy. Though there are some very successful comedy clubs that either don't have a compere or have a compere that just introduces people off a clipboard, and they're still great gigs. So we're not essential, but we do make a difference. But it's in the moment, because the thing about stand-up is, especially when people come into it from an acting perspective, it's really easy. No, it's not easy. It's really straightforward, better phrase, to write, finesse, and rehearse a brilliant set, irrespective of the crowd in front of you.
Sure.
So even though every comic does tweak for audio or the delay before people laugh or their environment, you know, makes a mention of the curtains behind them, 95% of their act is identical. You know this, you've seen comics numerous times. Yeah. You've seen them do the same stuff.
Yeah.
Of course, people will naturally tweak and adapt to their environment. But the problem with that is that if people want to watch incredible, well-rehearsed, well-performed stand-up, they can just watch the Apollo on YouTube.
Yeah, exactly. You know,
you need to have a reward for being in the room, being live. This is where the online comedy has been so interesting, because you're still watching on a screen, but you're in the moment.
Yeah.
So it's got to happen there and then. I much prefer comparing online than I do to doing another set. Though, admittedly, when I do a set, I will chat to people as well. And it's just the reminder of the fact that you've got a brain that allows you to be wired for comedy and to take the impetus of what's going on behind you, to make a comment about it, to bring in something you've mentioned earlier on, to segue into a material you've got, an observation or an idea that might be related to something that person said or what they're dressed or who they're with. And all those sort of like twists and turns reward people for the fact that they're watching comedy live. Because what is the point in watching comedy live if the people that you're watching aren't going to do it like it's live? So you have to be in the moment, mention what's going on. Actually, sometimes quite important to not mention what's going on. Like if there's a band next door, never mention it, because then all the people do is hear it. Don't mention the fact it's boiling hot.
Yeah,
otherwise, everyone suddenly realizes they're hot when they're, you know. So, but it's also, it's about ensconcing that crowd in an environment that you've developed and you generated, but giving them the feeling like it only ever happened that one time. Amount of times, like, you know, he was never really a joke comic, but Rufus Hound, when he was a compere, was hugely successful because he gave people the idea that what they were watching could only ever happen that day, exactly, in that moment, at that time, right? And of course, it's a device, and he's an incredible improviser, you know, and so he knows how to kind of to steer a room in that direction, to provide the misdirection to engineer it how he wants it. But that was such an important technique and skill.
Sure, that,
you know, people would always construe that as being the funniest man there. And also people come up to me afterwards and they say, after comparing, they go, oh, that was brilliant. You know, you should be a comedian. And of course, they don't realize that could be wildly insulting. But of course, what's happened is they've just seen me react to stuff going on and have thought that everything was off the top of my head. And quite often it is, but quite often it was once ages ago. It went really funny. I thought, I'll remember that and I'll do that again the next time it happens. Like when I ask an audience something, even if it's an open-ended question, not a yes, no question, and they think they're giving me an original answer, they aren't. There's probably only four or five answers to every question ever.
Yeah.
And every single person who thinks they've come up with something original, is just a carbon copy of the last person who thought the same thing. So, yeah.
That's really
so
interesting.
Oh, how did it come up with it at the top of his head? It's because I've been doing this 24 years.
Yeah.
And you're nowhere near as original as you think. In fact, if someone says something genuinely original, quite often I will just tiptoe off the stage, go up to them and give them a little pat on the back and say, well done, that was excellent. It's so rare.
It's interesting what you say, because it reminded me of a story when we went to the Edinburgh Fringe in 2012. We were in the BBC tent and we're watching BBC Comedy Live, and Jared Christmas was the compere. Yeah. And when the show started, on the big screen outside was the Olympics closing ceremony, and all the audience were half watching the ceremony and the comedy show. And that man really took his audience, just like you say, of the moment. And everybody just completely ignored the opening ceremony, and we're all around him at the end of it and supporting the act. And he took the roof off that night. And
well, Jared's excellent. And Jared's also one of those people who's, you know, he's able to elevate the energy and the focus. And
Yeah.
I've talked to Jared about some of the gigs that he does that I, you know, like I got offered one, sort of like it was like a midday thing in a nightclub for groups of sort of others, and, you know, and it's, and they were drinking like for an hour, you know, like midday drinkers. And I went, I'm never doing that. And he goes, I'm doing it. I'll do it like that. And I said, how was it? It was fine. He said, really hard work. And he liked the challenge. He likes the difficulty that comes with it. In fact, being next to the closing ceremony would be most of our ideas of hell. But Jared would have just gone, right, let's do this, you know. So,
comparing it, because that is very true from what you were saying with your answer. How do you remember all your routines? Do you have a way of remembering them? Do you have pointers in your head? Do you make notes? Do you practice?
Well, remembering the routine itself is parrot fashion. So I say it, I remember it, I say it, but it's always in my voice, like I would say it anyway. So they're always going to be slightly different each time anyway. It's only when I've done something about 50 times does it start becoming a bit word for word the same.
Sure.
When it comes to linking routines together to make a set, if it's a 20-minute set, I've got enough stuff in my head, I will just think of the next thing that comes into my head that suits the room. If I'm doing an hour's show, I will use symbolics. So if I've got a routine that's about a sandwich toaster and it goes on to a routine about eBay, I'll just imagine the fact that I sold my sandwich toaster on eBay. You know, and so, I will just have an idea in my head, and then that will just go, right, eBay, that's the trigger. So you know how comics quite often have got like a set list written on their hand?
Sure, yeah.
It's like a series of things about what they're going to talk about, and it's normally just a word, because they've learned routines in those words. And of course, so your routines are a bit like, if you're like a manager of a football team, and your routines are like your players, and you sort of bring them in and out, but they kind of, they're encapsulated within one thing. Once you've got the routine right, you tend to not leave it. You tend to leave it alone and then just move it into different places and add it to other routines, you know, and stuff like that. So the actual routines are parrot fashion, and for shows, I try and link them together.
What ambitions, if any, do you have as a comedian or compere?
I'll do compere first. I'll tell you why, because without being too pompous, there's nothing really left for me to do as a compere.
Right.
I mean, I could host the Royal Variety or something like that, or host, you know, Live at the Apollo, or, you know, something that's very high profile. But there is nothing technically to do with any of those jobs that I haven't done or couldn't do, or couldn't do really well, I hope, anyway. So from an artistic perspective, there isn't a huge amount of comparing ambition left.
Sure.
There are some tough comparing jobs, like hosting the Golden Globes or hosting the BAFTAs, or, you know, or the Brits, you know. And when you know, Jack Whitehall does that, I always watch to see where his, you know, where his hurdles are.
Yeah.
You know, so from an ambition point of view, when it comes to the business side of things, yeah, of course, I'd like to do that. But that will come with sort of profile and you know, just being better and people wanting you to do the job, and maybe that won't happen because, you know, it's there's an age thing and an image thing as well that goes with it. From a comedian point of view, it's just to continue getting better. My role was always is that if I'm not better than I was a couple of years ago, then I'll either do something else or reboot myself, because I will lose the drive to do this if I plateau. So I'm constantly trying to improve. The only problem is that me as a proposition is changing. I'm getting older. My references are different. My connections are different. I will appear different to an audience as well.
Sure.
So I've got to, I can't really reinvent myself. I've just got to get better at what it is that I do. But I like that challenge. And yeah. I watch people who are really, really funny. The Romeshes, the Sean Walshes, the Steve Kamoses of the world. And I look at the joke and then I look at the performance and I realize that they're wringing out such a huge amount of performance out of the joke that there's always more to go. And, you know, until McIntyre came along, we all just thought we had to be either lucky or just had a good idea. And then McIntyre would work. He would be good. And then he'd work until he was great. And then he'd be great, but he would still work on the act and himself and the delivery until he was incredible. And then even then he wouldn't stop until he was the best.
Yeah.
And so we also sat back and thought, well, God, look what happens when you continue to work. Because when you're a comic, if you can get a room full of people to really laugh at something, you tend to take your foot off the pedal. You think, I've done that. And he didn't stop. And he kind of taught the rest of us.
Yeah.
Taught the rest of us that if you could be that good, then the success would be that much. Revolutionary, really.
Do you prefer comparing to doing a solo routine? Is there a difference at all? Or?
Oh, yeah, there's a huge difference. I mean, there's practical differences. Like, if you just do a set, you can arrive later and go home earlier.
Right.
That's nice. if you're comparing as well, you do tend to get treated like a member of staff. And after the show, when you're standing at the side having a drink, half the people will say you're really funny. The other half will ask you where the toilet is. So, I mean, it's because they think you're a member of staff. So it's not great for your ego to do the compare side of things. But I guess the absolute best comics in the world, the best comics in the world are people who do routines and do sets, because that's what, so you will go that route eventually. However, nearly all of them at some point have compared and they've needed to compare to learn the people interaction skills that allows them to become a better comedian. So I don't think one exists without the other.
Right, okay. We're all living in strange times. It's been a horrible 18 months. Everybody has had to cope with lockdowns and everything. How have you found online gigs? You said you've done a few of them. How have you found online gigs as opposed to live gigs?
It's very much the methadone to the heroin of live comedy.
I've never heard it put that way.
It is. It's definitely way better than not doing it.
Yeah.
Way better. But it's not, not only is it not the same, but it's kind of a medium in its own right.
Sure.
You know how someone's like really funny if they're a radio presenter?
Yeah.
And you think, oh, they'd be a great stand-up, and like, you think, well, maybe they wouldn't, you know, because it's a different skill set. But it's still funny, and they're still coming up with stuff at the top of their own head.
Yeah.
It's kind of the same with online comedy. And actually, it's been a really good opportunity for the live circuit to realise why social media comedians, the you know, everyone from the Dapper Laughs to the kind of guy named Mo and all the rest of them, why they're so good.
Yeah.
It's 'cause they understand the medium. And a lot of us have had to relearn the medium.
Yeah.
And understand why comedy works better online in some ways compared to stuff. And at the beginning, everyone was stood up holding a mic, trying to make it look like a comedy club. And some people still are, but I guess that's just kind of physical memory. People want to just do the thing that it looks like. But because actually, you know, look at the real trailblazers, the Stu Goldsmiths of the world, people like that. They sat down in front of a wall. They're talking like they're on a Zoom call. They're just funny and they're sparky and they're in charge and they're doing all the things that work in that environment. And they found it out because they haven't tried to recreate stand-up. They've just tried to do comedy online. So how have I found it really useful? It's not financially viable if you want to make a living out of it, unless you've got some incredible niche that you've explored. But most of all, it's been important for me as a performer to feel like I've still got a channel that I can take ideas and perform them and get people to laugh and see them do it. Even though the whole method and environment is nowhere near as rewarding or even just as reasonable as live, you know, without it, I would be rusty and a bit lost. So it's been really important. Like I said, there's the methadone to the heroin of the live circuit.
Yeah, brilliantly put. My view is, without online comedy, I don't know how I'd have got through lockdown, because I go to many an online night. However, I view it as a super substitute. I agree with you. It is better than not having nothing at all. But when online first started, you're right, there was no audio at all. And with my loud laugh, I was just sitting here laughing at four walls. I thought I was going to be taken away, you know, because you couldn't be heard. And then the audio started to open up. So they had like a 10 or 20 people on a virtual front row that could chat and laugh and everything. But having said that, for me, you can't beat a live performance. I so miss going out on a Saturday night, having a few beers, and then going to a live comedy show, because you're in the moment in that room, as you say, you know, anything can happen.
It's the shared experience as well, I'm not entirely sure is coming back completely. That shared experience about comedy being infectious, it's literally infectious in the same way as coronavirus infectious. In other words, you need to sit next to somebody to give it to them. And I think when we're all sat in a room with huge gaps or plastic screens between us, it will not be as good as it was before. It'll still work, and we'll still laugh, but it will not be as good. So we're a little way off the original shared experience of stand-up, going back to where it was, but it'll get there.
Yeah, I'm sure. Who are your favourite comedians, past and present? Who makes you laugh?
A lot of them make me laugh. I can think about, when you say past or present, past would imply they've died or retired. You know, when I was starting, Lee Evans was amazing, and he's technically retired, so I suppose he would be past. If I watch stand up from the archives, I remember Ben Elton being this sort of funny and making a point.
Which
I thought was great. But I was brought up in a political family where everyone made a point and nobody was funny. So it just kind of, it felt like I was getting the bonus of funny while someone preached to me, which, you know, sounds amazing. People like Rich Hall, I can really enjoy as a punter. And the reason why I can enjoy Rich Hall is because he's so different to me. It doesn't feel like I'm watching a contemporary. I feel like an audience member when I watch him. So I can be like a punter, and it's great, you know. But, you know, current comics, there are some outrageously good ones. I mean, McIntyre is one of the best, though he is an everyman comic. And so therefore totally he doesn't drill as deep as other ones would want. If you watch a lot of comedy, you might find other people you prefer. He's still probably the best. But Russell Kane is incredible.
Oh, superb. Yeah.
And has a way of continuing to deliver material in a way that just allows the laughs to build and build and build. I've rarely laughed as hard at a gig as I have watching Russell. Sean Walsh is probably the closest we got to a natural comedy comedian in the UK.
He's one of the best observationalists.
Yeah, he is. Well, not just the best observation, but clearly born to do it, which is rare. I mean, the phrase natural comedian gets bandied around too easily, but there are very few in this country. It's a lot of Canadian ones and a few Aussie ones, but not many British ones, but he's one of them. And also another good sign of someone's a natural comedian, if you look at them and you think, if it wasn't for comedy, what would you do? And he's definitely one of them. No, he's immense. I'm trying to think about the kind of the people who are just so, I suppose, kind of brilliant in form. I can easily think of a handful of people. But I'd say, like, Romesh has got that kind of dark postmodern malaise absolutely nailed.
Yeah, he's superb.
Just really, absolutely really good like that. Yeah. And then And then you've got, you know, people like Ian Stone can still really elevate the mundane in a way that other comics are really impressed by. And yet it's unique to him. And so I think, I could listen for hours, to be honest with you. But I you know, if you haven't seen any of those people I've just mentioned, then you're missing out.
I've seen them all.
Of course you have.
The reason why I ask it is that there's a section in my blog called The Ones That Got Away, and I've written about 25 comedians who have either passed on or haven't been able to see. And top of the tree were Morecambe and Wise. They're the reason why I love comedy. But I did see in the 70s Les Dawson and Tommy Cooper and Ken Dodd, and I was hooked from then on.
If you want to look at an original comic from that generation, who is much more of a catalyst to the live British stand-up comedy circuit as you see it now, check out Jasper Carrot.
Oh, he's brilliant. Yeah.
I mean, they were all brilliant. But the thing about Jasper Carrot was he had an opinion and he had an observation.
Yeah.
And he would string them together with jokes in monologue. Now, obviously, that he wasn't the very first person to do it. But realistically, he could do that back then and it was funny. And he could do that now and it would be funny. And it's not because he's a brilliant comic. Obviously, he's a brilliant comic. It's because the nature of his communication was quite personal. He wasn't going, here's a funny thing. He was going, I've got this opinion. Yeah. And it was up to us to realize it was funny. And I think that is the cornerstone of the obso comic now, the observation comic
sure,
now.
Yeah.
And I still think I look even though I mentioned Ben Elton, I watch back some Ben Elton stuff now as well, and it is aged, and it is the style of it. You go, it would be a bit like when he says that. No one says that in comedy anymore now because it's quite obvious. You know, however, Jasper Carrot would tell a story there would be no fat on it, and there would be well written and the meat of it. And yeah, the jokes would be obvious and there was, you could second guess it. And he wasn't probably the sharpest comic mind, but the style, the content, everything like that. It was the bridge between the comedy of before and the stand up of now, I think.
I saw Ben Elton at college in Stoke, and he was on stage for about 3 hours. This was in 1987, something like that. His theme, he picked a theme for each show that he did. And of course, being at college, it was all about student life. And then I saw him again in Carlisle, and it was all about local life. And it was astonishing the wealth of material he had as a comic, because he could just throw out new stories. He must have realized where he was and really thought about it as he went on stage. It was glorious.
Comics like to show off their brain. This is what they do. They like to show off their brain, you know, and he's got one. And a great writer, so, and that came across.
Yeah. Like me, before you were a comedian, or whilst you are a comedian, do you go to many comedy gigs as a member of the audience?
No.
No.
I do help run comedy sometimes when I'm not on.
No.
So I'll go along and I'll watch it. And because I'm comparing, I'll watch the other comics.
Yeah, yeah.
So I probably still watch more comedy than the vast majority of comedy fans, with the exception of you, Richard. I do watch more comedy. So I know people's routines very well. I know their material well.
Yeah.
So yeah, I do watch a lot of comedy. But out of choice, no. I mean, this is what I do for a living.
Yeah.
And much as I adore comedy and I've missed it terribly, it's still not a night off to go and watch it.
Sure. Just before we go, and I could chat to you all night, I've thoroughly enjoyed this. Thank you so much for your time. Is there anything else you would like to say? Have you got any online gigs coming up? Where can people find you on social media? That sort of thing.
Just head to stephengrant.com or just add us on Twitter. Tell us you've listened to this as well. It'd be great to know you've heard it. You know, and I'll get a chance to say hi. But yeah, no, just follow us on social media, really. It's a mixture of my real life and my comic ideas. But then it isn't all comedy. Well, for me, it is anyway. So, yeah, that's it. I try not to do this sort of thing to sell stuff. If you really want to buy something off me, I run an online comedy escape room. So get some friends together and play that. And I host an online escape room where it's a genuine escape room, but it's with me hosting it. That you might enjoy that.
Brilliant. Well, I, for one, am looking forward very, very much to come into the Comedia and seeing you again at the Creator Comedy Club live. I believe the Brighton Fringe is going to go ahead. I'm just reading anyway that this year, who knows? I'm really looking forward to coming to see you again soon. And thank you so much for your time, and all the very best to you.
All right. Thanks very much, Richard. Cheers.
Thank you. All the best.
Thanks.